You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We have a very special conversation today. We all know the problems that we're facing in so many cities and towns around California and across the country with the problem of homelessness, of people have been displaced, and especially in COVID, just the great difficulties we had. And so I am so happy to have been introduced to Elizabeth Funk by one of my clients, Ed Chan, who found time during COVID to spend more time with this project called Dignity Moves. So I want Elizabeth, welcome Elizabeth.
Thank you.
I want you to tell us about a couple of things. I want to tell us about Dignity Moves and what that means and how it got started and a little bit more about your background as well. So let us hear about it.
Sure. Thanks, Will. So my background is as an impact investor. I've spent the last 18 years really kind of trying to help for-profit ventures be more impactful and helping nonprofits be more sustainable and really try to bring those two together and have for-profit investment dollars be invested for good and helping people invest with their values. So my current fund is based in Latin America, and we do quite a bit of low-income housing and sustainable agriculture and other investments in places like Nicaragua and Panama and so forth. And so I've been very involved in the housing world for quite some time, but I had not been involved with anything here at home. And so when the pandemic hit, I made the decision that I wanted to spend time addressing the local problems that we were seeing on our streets. And so I came together with a group of members, fellow members of Young Presidents Organization, YPO. So the YPO is made up of CEOs and presidents of companies that are, you know, it's a global organization. So a group of us came together and created a task force that we called it to just see what we could do, how we could bring our collective business wisdom and expertise and contacts to try to address the homelessness crisis. So we started researching it and coming to understand that, you know, first of all, the East Coast and West Coast have had very different approaches to how they've thought about homelessness. On the East Coast, largely because of the weather, the budgets have gone towards shelter so that everybody can have a bed that wants one. But there's then very little money left over for permanent housing. On the West Coast, we've had the opposite strategy where we've spent all of our energy and all of our money on permanent housing. And that means that the 72% of our homeless remain unsheltered while they wait for permanent housing. And permanent housing literally costs $700,000 per unit for supposedly, you know, affordable housing or permanent supportive housing in California. And it takes 5 years. And so that waiting list gets longer and longer. And especially with COVID and job losses, when these eviction moratoriums expire, we expect that waiting list to go through the roof. And so we started looking at what could we do to be involved in addressing that 72% who are unsheltered, who are literally on the streets and in encampments. And the good news is that there are lots of tools available at our disposal. So for instance, there are, because of the accessory dwelling unit laws that have come into California where you can have a cabin in your backyard, there are all sorts of manufacturers out there now who are manufacturing these prefabricated modular little cabins. The other thing that is in our favor is that California declared a shelter crisis. And because of that, cities can use the state's emergency building codes, which allow a very streamlined process for building these interim communities. And so what we've done is we have selected a couple of different manufacturers that we like, depending on how the project comes together. But we've got these units that are designed that are really inexpensive, $10,000 per unit compared to $700,000 for permanent housing. And the way we can do that is because you take the most expensive part of a house out. You take the kitchen and the bathroom and you have those be shared. Kind of like college dorm living, which, you know, my college dorm days were my favorite, even though I had to go down the hall to go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, we really think that we could kind of reimagine what housing looks like, and especially for, for some portion of the population that might be even a better fit for them long term. But we've got these little sort of dorm rooms that we have designed, and they're portable. And so the beauty of it is that we can take advantage of underutilized land, land that might only be available for a few years. Say, for instance, somebody's got a headquarters they plan to build in 5 years. We should be using that land in the meantime. Or, of course, as you and I were speaking about a moment ago, faith-based organizations who have land that they aren't interested in selling or having a permanent development on, but that might be willing to let us build interim housing in the meantime. And then what Dignity Moves does is we play sort of the role of developer, where we come in and we help find the land, we help find the funding, and then most importantly, we help find the services agency that will come in and operate these units. Housing alone does not solve homelessness, particularly for a population that's been on the street and has had all of the trauma that comes with that. We need to have really intensive case management where people come in and work with you on helping you get connected to mental health or physical health, or get connected to your, you know, all of your security benefits and job placement and all, just really working with that, with those residents so that they can return to self-sufficiency.
All right. That sounds like just an amazing project. And do you have projects now going on?
We do. Our first project, we helped Life Moves, which is a big, major services agency in Silicon Valley, the largest. We collaborated with them on this idea, and they applied for Project Home Key funding from the state and built a site that is actually open just last week, I'm pleased to say. And it will have room for 124 people, 88 individuals and 12 families. We also have projects underway in Santa Barbara and San Francisco, and we are actively talking to city and county governments across the West Coast to see if we could do these in places in LA, San Gabriel Valley, Oakland. We're having lots of those conversations.
Let's suppose that you are talking right now with a faith-based organization or somebody who has land that they've banked waiting for something else, or a company that has land that they're waiting to build on. What do they need to do to make this happen?
All they need to do is formally give us permission to use the land. So we would do a lease agreement, hopefully for a dollar, but it could be more. But what we then do is come in and we play the role of developer. So we are the ones who help raise the money to buy the units and build the units. And we think that's the right role for philanthropy, is to invest in the units themselves. I think donors really like to donate to something they can see and touch. What's a lot harder is to raise the money for the ongoing services. And so the deal we're making to cities is that we'll raise philanthropy to buy the units and to set these up if the city or county will agree to commit to paying for the ongoing services. So we help pull those pieces together. And then we have a project management team. So we bring in the architect and the general contractor and the electrical engineer. We make all these things happen. And then we find the services agency. So, really the landowner doesn't need to do anything other than agree to let us borrow the land.
And I like the term borrow the land, because that's really what you're doing.
Yes.
What's the minimum amount of time that you would be able to use borrowed land for?
2 years would probably be the minimum. It's just it's a lot of work to get the permits and so forth. And so it's a lot of upfront work. And so, which we will take care of, but it means that, that I think 2 years is probably a good idea. And on the permits, we have Gensler, which is the largest architectural firm in the world, has agreed to do our sites pro bono for us and is working with us on making these lovely communities. They are not just a row of boxes, but they're setting them up with courtyards and fountain and really trying to make them feel like a place where someone's going to feel comfortable and safe and have a sense of belonging. And the other really important thing that I kind of take for for granted, so I want to make sure I have missed it, is the whole point of this is that this is a new form of interim housing. This is not shelter. Shelter is, you know, the word means to me, the, you know, big warehouses with a bunch of bunk beds. And, you know, the homeless didn't like those before for understandable reasons. They didn't feel safe there, but they are definitely not safe now. And so our model is that everybody has their own room with a door that locks, either for an individual or a larger unit for families, but everyone gets their own room with a door that locks, and that gives them the safety and security. Also means they can bring their pets, which is important, that you usually can't at a shelter. And it means that, you know, women feel safe, which I know was a real issue for women in shelters, where you can lock your door at night.
Well, you used an interesting term, interim housing. What does that mean?
So we're actually calling it interim supportive housing. And interim means, well, quite frankly, because we don't want to use the word shelter because it's got so many negative connotations now. Right. And we want to distinguish that. So it's an interim place where people come and get stabilized. They come in off of the streets. We pull them out of survival mode, which is what they've been in. And that gives them the ability to start to work on their life and the underlying causes of homelessness. And so that interim supportive role where the services agencies can come in, but honestly, just the basics, like they're not having to worry about their next meal, they're getting showers, they've got Wi-Fi, which for some of us is a survival necessity. And then, you know, a lot of miraculous things happen at that point. It's not a one for one that everybody who's in interim housing needs to get into permanent supportive housing in the local community. We find that once people have been stabilized and cleaned up and maybe sober, lots of other exits of homelessness can happen. They can reunite with family, and we can help them do that and help them find a long lost aunt that's got a guest room. And we can also help them think about relocating to a less expensive city, help them think about finding a job there. That would have been a daunting idea to try to do when you're on the streets and your cell phone's dead. But, you know, there are other ways we can help them in that interim stage. And then, of course, some portion of them will need to move on to permanent supportive housing. And some may get vouchers and move on to self-sufficiency.
So what I'm hearing is in a sense, this is a magnet to draw in people who are on the street into an attractive place without a lot of the negative experience of a shelter, but draw them into an attractive place where they can have a longer term place to live, and then when they're drawn in, then to apply the supportive social services that we have to help them establish a trajectory into a more stable long term place.
Yeah, and you know the reason to do this interim housing stage is really, first of all, the humanitarian reason, which is that people shouldn't be sleeping on the streets. But the other reason is that you do want to attract them in. I like your word magnet, where folks out in encampments, we can't reach them with services. And so the lure, if I could say it, the draw is you can have your own room, and then we can get them in and get them those services. And that they might have been service resistant and they might have been shelter resistant, but if they can have their own room, they might be willing to come. And then we've got a chance to help them feel safe and help them start thinking about you know, their next steps. There was an interesting survey that the city of Goleta did recently of folks who are living in encampments and said, what is keeping you from going into a shelter? The number one reason by far is I want to have my own space. The 70%, I think it was, said that. That's what's keeping them. And so if we can overcome that and have people have their own space, and of course, second and third reasons were, I want to be able to bring my pet and I don't like the bunk bed setups of shelters, all of those go away. So I think we've got a real chance to reach folks who were resistant before.
Well, it seems to me that in the encampment, that tent is my personal space.
Right.
My wife runs an outreach center in Riverside, and I'm very aware that there are people who sleep on the streets every night. They have places that they go behind uh, behind the Safeway, behind the electric building. They have places where they go and sleep on the street at night. And so that encampment, that tent, is a step up from sleeping in the park at night. And so to just come in and say, we're taking that away from you, of course they're going to resist that. Right? Mm-hmm. Now what I hear you saying is you're making a huge mental and emotional switch that I think is very important for us as a country to do, which is, that is not a problem. Those are people. It's not the homeless problem. It's, there are people who don't have a safe, attractive place to live.
Right.
They are not being treated currently as human beings who have needs. They're being treated as a problem we have to get rid of.
Yeah, and you know, we all have to stop and understand the crisis mode that they're in. When you're in survival mode, you know, you're working with a different part of your brain, and it's the part that blocks you from thinking clearly, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're literally worried for their life, both their physical safety, whether they're going to be able to eat. They can't be expected to figure out a way to become productive members of society, right? You've got to get folks out of survival mode where they can breathe and be calm and become human and start to self-actualize and become the human that they are meant to be, which you can't do when you're in survival mode. And so we've got such a stereotype of homeless as people being crazy and being, you know, irrational and whatever. And some portion of them are, and some portion of them sadly have found drugs because it's a relief from their reality that they're facing. But I think, you know, once they're stabilized, a great portion of those folks would let that go. These are still human beings. They're just in survival mode. And so lots of times they can't act like the humans that we expect them to be.
Well, and a lot of that, I believe, has to do with us. It's the Arbinger Institute's done a lot of work. One of their great books is called The Anatomy of Peace. And in that, they talk about how many people live inside the box. That's what they call it, inside the box. And inside the box, it's all about me. And the other out there is an object that I have to manipulate, deal with, push around. Maybe I'm going to try to, be nice to get them to do something for me. To be out of the box is to see another person as having an equal ability to exercise what and to seek what they want. And that's the shift that I find so important to move from, this is a problem we've got to deal with, to, these are human beings. And if we can begin to listen to them and help them get what they want, and goodness gracious, when you think about how American economy has functioned over the last 25, 30, 40 years, that we all are striving to become the best, to become, have the most toys, to have our world protected. And then here's not one or two, but hundreds of thousands of people who are not in that place. And how do we see them? And how do we move from this? Well, they failed. They don't have, they're just a problem to deal with. To move from that to, they are human beings who have needs, and we can listen to those needs, and we, in one of the wealthiest countries in the history of this world, we can supply those needs when we choose to.
It's truly unacceptable, and I think that, you know, the problem is that the homelessness crisis has been going on so long in California, particularly, that we've just become numb to it, and I think there's been a little bit of giving up. Right, which is, there's just this sense of there's nothing we can do. And it's so wrong. It's so wrong. And we have the tools at our disposal. But I love the idea of helping people help themselves. I got my start in impact investing in the microfinance industry, which is giving people small loans so that they can build their own way out of poverty. And I think interim housing is sort of similar, is get people a chance, get them out of survival mode where they know where their meals are coming from and they can get showered and they've at least got a chance to then think about what they're going to do next to solve their problems and solve them themselves and give them the help to do that. But I really feel like we need to believe in these folks a bit and get them to where they can then and give them the tools and give them the help, which we all need. And by the way, I also think that the stereotype of homeless being, you know, people who failed and it's their fault, I think something's going to change. I predict that when this eviction moratorium expires, you're going to start to see your kindergarten teacher. You're going to start to see your mailman, right? We're going to start to see people who yes, they failed because their job didn't pay them enough. Many of those people have jobs. It just doesn't pay enough. These are not people who are failures. These are people who got dealt a bad luck. And I think that when we start to, when it starts to be personal for us and we know people who we consider people falling into homelessness, I hope that the perception will change.
What are we going to do when that happens? How will we handle a family that my kindergarten teacher who has been evicted from their house? What are we going to do as a city, a town, a state, a nation?
Well, my hope is that we can get those people into dignified interim housing immediately, because the longer people are on the streets, the studies show the higher probability that the problem becomes acute. It's trauma to live on the streets. And traumas can happen to you, like rapes and whatever. But you can also, you know, it takes one cold night and somebody offers you drugs to get through the night. And now we really have a problem, right? And so I think that from a policy perspective, if we can intercept that immediately and get people into a safe, dignified, stable place and tell them they've got 3 or 6 months or 12 months, whatever, you know, it's not indefinite, but some interim period of time, and help and support them. It's not, you know, we can do these units, we can build these units for $10,000 a door, right? I feel like it's society's obligation to have a proper safe place for people to land when they fall.
Well, we know they're gonna fall, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not, what we've been talking about up until just now has been the people who are in encampments right now, or who are below that living in the park. But come the time when the eviction moratorium is over, we're going to have a whole different group of people who are on the street.
And well, you know, those are going to be first time homeless.
Yes.
Those are going to be people who aren't savvy about how to navigate the back streets. And right?
Yes.
These are going to be people who are experiencing homelessness for the first time. And the UCLA did an estimate. So UCLA in Los Angeles County, as of the last point in time count, there were 60,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night.
Right.
UCLA's study estimates that in the next 12 months, 120,000 households, not individuals, households will experience homelessness for the first time in the next 12 months. That's an order of magnitude more people than are out there now.
Okay, so what do we expect? What will we do for those 120,000 people? And I don't think it's bad luck. I think it's circumstance.
Yes.
I mean, it is a circumstance. I mean, how did we get into this circumstance? Well, COVID and the economic, closing businesses. I mean, those are things that we chose to do, and that affected the income. And so now we're in this sort of reconciliation mode. I mean, how do we get the economy back going? And then how do we wind up dealing with the landlords who had to pay mortgages and the people who couldn't pay rent and all of this? How do we reconcile all of that?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I think that the point that you made, that we chose to shut down the economy, Mm-hmm. And we could all agree or not agree on whether that was the right thing to do, but that was the policy that we chose to shut mm-hmm. down the economy in order to save lives. And mm-hmm. if we're going to do that, then we also, as a government and as a society, have an obligation to deal with the repercussions of that choice. And the repercussions of that choice are that people are becoming homeless. And we have an obligation. We can't shut down the economy and then let people fend for themselves if that has hurt them. So I feel like, you know, to be honest, with those 120,000 households in LA, just using LA as an example, we're not going to build 120,000 new permanent units in the next 12 months.
Well, and it's not that we need to have new units for it, because the housing is still there when they leave that house, right? Because they couldn't or didn't pay rent. The house is still there. It's not like we've lost the housing stock. This is a little different from the current 60,000 people in LA who are on the streets in encampments or in the parks. This is people moving out of a space. And what's going to be interesting is what does the landlord do to fill that space? If you have 160,000 people who are out on the streets in a period of weeks, who's going to move in?
Well, this is where I think the, you know, there are voucher programs, rapid rehousing programs, rental assistance programs. And really what we ought to be doing is doing the rental assistance before someone gets evicted, not even go through this cycle of having them have to move out and then somebody else maybe is lucky enough to move in. We need to do the eviction prevention and intercept at that point.
Well, I can promise you there are not 160,000 people in LA right now who are sitting there waiting to move into a rental space.
Yeah.
So it's not going to particularly help the landlord to evict that person.
It's a difficult problem.
Oh. All right. So let's move on to another one. Let's suppose that treat me as a landowner or a faith-based institution who has land. What does it need to be? What do I need to have in terms of land? What does it need to look like? What sort of, tell me, do I have land? Will it qualify or will it be sufficient?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. So first, it needs to be near where the homeless are. It needs to be a place that would be accessible and where somebody who's experiencing homelessness would want to be. And so it needs to be near public transportation or near, you know, a 7-Eleven, I don't know, right? Like in a proper, it can't be way out in the outskirts where they can't get their lives back together and get access to their services and potentially job interviews and so forth. So centrally located, it does not need to be large. We're doing a project in Santa Barbara on a quarter of an acre and we can get 35, 36 people there. So a parking lot, for instance, is ideal. If it's flat and paved, that's super easy for us. We can just come put these units down on the ground. And then when the landowner needs the land back, we can pick them up with a forklift and move them to the next location. So a paved parking lot, but it doesn't have to be paved. It should be flat, relatively flat. Otherwise, people's cabins are going to be to piece. But it doesn't have to be perfectly flat. We can adjust for that. But mostly it's about the central location and available for a few years.
You mentioned a parking lot. Now, with the parking lot, will it also have the landscaping that you were talking about and the design?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the project that we're doing in Santa Barbara is taking over a part of a parking lot that the county owns. And we're going to put up fences around it, which is very important because people need to feel like this home is safe. And a lot of the important thing is that people feel safe because they haven't felt safe. And so in addition to their locked door, we put a fence around the community and we block that off. And that becomes sort of a really special place. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of alluded to, but that I want to mention is that we're also involved with, which is trying to think about why a community like this couldn't actually be someplace permanent for someone to stay. Mm-hmm. Right? Because we're talking about getting people into interim housing, which is sort of a waiting room while they wait for permanent housing. But that permanent housing is there's going to be a long waiting list. And so it begs the question, why couldn't they just stay there? And for some portion of the population, going straight from the streets into a studio apartment is not successful.
Let me tell you the story. My wife in Riverside at St. Michael's Church, there was a family, the fellow who had been working at the church. She has small stipends that she pays for, helping to mow the grass and things like that, which is a nice, great thing that comes through contributions. And this particular family had been living in a home for 8 to 10 years, and the home was sold. Hmm. I mean, they had a couple of rooms in this home. The home was sold, so they were out. And so she did things that would, she wasn't supposed to do by letting them live in the church, in the parish hall. But she was with them every day for 4 months looking for housing. Mm-hmm. All right, now they have a budget. They have a limited amount of resources. But do you know that there is nothing available for a family for less than $1,700 in Riverside?
Mm.
And of course the list for public housing is just enormous.
Yes.
And it's like there's no place for them to live.
Well, and it is because it really does cost $600,000 or $700,000 per unit to build. And so they've got to charge that kind of rent. And this is where we're trying to get involved from a policy perspective, which is to redefine the definition of housing. And I think there should be no reason why someone shouldn't be able to pay rent or use a voucher for a room, despite the fact that the kitchen and bathroom are shared. And I think now you create a whole new category of housing. And I mean housing in the sense of someplace somebody could live forever, right? But that has the expensive pieces taken out and shared. And therefore, we can produce that and we can charge a couple $100 a month rent, right? Now you can solve your housing crisis.
So let me ask you, if somebody were to assemble pieces of land around Orange County or Los Angeles County, assemble pieces of land, you could come in and help put this interim supportive housing on it.
That's correct.
Land. So would it make sense that a group of people take that on, the task of identifying land?
Absolutely. That would be amazing.
I'm wondering what that would look like. What would it look like? The coyotes looking for land in all the right places, right? I guess it was a song about looking for love in all the wrong places, but looking for land in all the right places, huh?
You know, we're finding that first of all, the government owns more land than they realize. They own parking lots that aren't being used that are associated with government buildings. Schools that get closed because they're not seismically sound and the parking lots around those. So first of all, the governments own more land than they realize. And I think that it's just been very difficult to get them to all figure out what they own because they don't all really know. And so
Roman Catholic Church, all this land all around the world. And literally nobody knows. And there was one woman who took on the job of organizing that for them. So sounds like that's what we need to do, because what I'm hearing from you is that you have one part of the solution in hand. So what I'm hearing is that you don't have a land inventory. And I know, I'm thinking out loud right now. I know the fellow who put together the mapping situation where he can look at, he has software that you tell him the address, he'll tell you who owns it.
Oh, I need him.
Yeah.
Because the mayor's office in LA has given me a list of properties that they own that are designated to become permanent housing sometime. And we're going through and trying to figure out, because that's a perfect example. If this is land that is owned by the city or county that is designated to become permanent housing someday, but they're the developer is going to take the 4 years to put together the
It's Mary's project.
And then another 4 years of entitlements. Yeah. We want to be using that land in the meantime. And so we need to, start getting creative about getting through the bureaucracy and figuring out what land these cities and counties own. But also, somebody who's got a big box retail store and, only half of the parking lot is used, right? Or faith-based organizations that don't want to part with land they own.
Right. I can see right now. I can see right now what we can do is we can find a group of people. And I'm thinking of my good friend who is one of the top commercial real estate brokers in Orange County. Right. He would be wonderful to have on it. And I'm thinking of my friend who has the mapping software that he licenses that out to developers who are doing exactly what you're doing, but they're looking for land that they can buy and then develop on. And so I'm thinking what if we had 12 to 15 people in this group? And we said, our job is to find how many do you want, Elizabeth? How many pieces of land do you want? I don't want to overwhelm you.
Well, how many homeless folks do you have in Orange County?
I don't know, but we know there's 60,000 in LA.
60,000 in LA. Yes. Right. So, I think we could probably do 5 projects at a time, maybe 10.
Okay. All right. So
is a goal.
We want to find 10. Our goal is to find 10 properties. That's doable. That. Why would that
I
not
would
be doable?
Love that. Yes.
Right.
No, that would be amazing.
Okay.
That would be amazing. And then the other things that we need from the public are two other things. One is just support, positive support for this idea of interim housing, because the NIMBY voice is still very real, the not in my backyard, where people want the homelessness problem fixed, but somewhere else. And so we've done a lot of work to make sure that the product that we're using is really attractive, and we're going to work with Gensler to set up beautiful sites. So it's going to be something you're going to be willing to have in your neighborhood, but every neighborhood needs to be okay with letting us do this. So we need voices of positive support. And then the other thing that we're going to need on a project by project basis is help financing the project itself. So if we do one in Santa Barbara, then we will go to the local Santa Barbara community and ask them to step up to help us with the construction costs. The good news is, it's not very expensive, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very doable, but those are the other things that we need.
Well, it sounds to me like the first thing for you, first thing would be identifying the 5 to 10 pieces of property. Reasonably level land, that's not the top priority. Paved would be acceptable. Near public transportation and near commercial sites like 7-Eleven, where they can get food.
Yeah, really kind of where the homeless are. So, I got a phone call from somebody near Salinas recently who says, my dad owns this piece of land and the homeless are sleeping on it. Like, this is where they sleep, right? So he says, I think you should turn this into interim housing. And I said, I think that's in a good location. I don't have to see where the public transportation is. If you're already there, you don't want to relocate people too much if they're, if they're already in that region, in that neighborhood, then that seems to be the right place to be. Yeah.
Well, another thing that I don't think we've mentioned is that this is not something that's constructed on site. This is brought in. This is constructed.
Well, actually, a little bit of both, which is that the parts, the walls and the panels and everything are all panels that are prefabricated. They're made in Los Angeles. And then they come to the site and they are assembled kind of like Legos, and they can be done by volunteers. And that's one of the things that I think is really lovely, is that we'll still need a general contractor to oversee it all, and it's particularly with the electricity. But the panels can be assembled by volunteers, which I think is lovely.
Wow. Amazing. Elizabeth, this is really very mind expanding and a challenge for all of us to, you know, to step up, find the land, help raise the funds, and support it.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate you, and I appreciate your support and your enthusiasm. I really truly believe that if we all come together, we can prevent the street sleeping and the unsheltered homelessness crisis that is already existed, but is about to get so much worse. And Let's preempt that.
Yeah. Well, when you think about America, we have never not solved a problem that we wanted to solve.
Well, I want to solve this one.
Well, I think hopefully this conversation, making that available to folks, can help people recognize that it is solvable. That we have technology, we have imagination, we have the tools to solve it. It's really a matter of choosing to solve it and then going out and doing it.
And helping people solve it for themselves, getting them to a place where they can.
Oh, well, that's the longer term piece. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what we're doing is creating the magnet where for most people, they want to reject the homeless and get them out. What we're doing is trying to create a magnet for it so we can draw them in to a place where they've got interim housing and the supportive services that are going to help them establish the trajectory to help them get what they want.
Perfectly said.
Oh my goodness, that's the kingdom of heaven. That is the kingdom of heaven. Wonderful, Elizabeth. Thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to say before we finish up?
Well, I want to say thank you to you, because it is community leaders like yourselves who are helping us get the word out and helping change the opinions and the biases about homelessness and starting to get to a can-do attitude. And I really think that if we've got more Will Christs in this world who are out there with the can-do attitude, I really think the tide's going to change, and we're going to roll up our sleeves and make something happen.
I have the group of people in mind that I'm going to put together and show this to, and we're going to do that.
Thank you.
I do believe that. Well, thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. And this is just another example of how people in California and businesses thrive when they choose to.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Christ.